You're listening to Radio Golf Show.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Frank Forster with another episode of Radio Golf Show. When we started thinking about a podcast back in 2015, 2016, and finally made the decision to go ahead with it, there were two people who were on our at the very top of our bucket list of non-golfers. One of them was Cher, and that's a whole different story. But the other person is with us today, and that's Rupert Sheldrake. I became aware of Rupert. I guess it was in right around 2008, maybe, when I got a hold of Wim Kaiser's documentary, "A Glorious Accident," which I believe was filmed in the 90s, and Rupert was one of six protagonists in a roundtable discussion on consciousness, along with Oliver Sacks, Daniel Bennett, Stephen Jay Gould, Freeman Dyson, who I was really Googling at the time, and Stephen Toulmin. And most of them didn't really want to talk about consciousness at all. And I was amazed by this young man who waited his turn and really let him have it. I think he asked the hard questions and put them on the spot. And this man again is here today. Rupert, thank you very much for doing this. I appreciate it. Welcome to the show. And maybe we can start here. What are your memories of that very session, A Glorious Accident?
Well, it was part of a series in which Wim Kaiser had interviewed for a whole day all of the six participants. He came to London, interviewed me for a whole day, and that turned into a 100-minute episode. And so by the time this round table happened, all six people had had a 100-minute portrait on the TV show. So the viewers in the Netherlands, it was primarily broadcast in the Netherlands and then later on PBS in the United States, they'd got to know each of us quite well. I mean, he did a brilliant interview dealing with our childhood, our attitudes, our interests outside our work and so forth, filmed in our homes. So people in the Netherlands felt they'd got to know these six people. They realized that the views they had were very different from each other. And then the idea was we all came together for this roundtable discussion. And when I got to Amsterdam the night before, I found that I was in a hotel and none of the others were there. So I rang Wim Kaiser and said, you know, could you tell me where Stephen Jay Gould is? Because there are a lot of things I want to discuss with him. And he doesn't seem to be in this hotel. And he said, no, you're all in separate hotels. He said, because I don't want the best conversations to happen the night before in the bar. And I said, well, at least I could travel in with him tomorrow to Hilversum to the studio. He said, no, you're all coming in separate cars. And so then we were in separate rooms at the studio. And then,
oh, my God.
When he brought me on, there were already two or three of them sitting round the table. And no, he brought me and Daniel Dennett on from opposite doors and at the same time. And he said, Daniel Dennett, he said, when I interviewed you in Boston, Massachusetts, you said of Rupert Sheldrake, he's brilliant, but completely wrong. If he didn't exist, he'd have to be invented as a foil for ordinary science. And he said, Rupert Sheldrake, when I interviewed you, you said of Daniel Dennett, he's brilliant, but I can't understand why someone so intelligent is convinced we're nothing but machines. And he said, well, gentlemen, And the conversation flowed for about 8 hours. And before it started, I said to Wim Kaiser, I see you've got us sitting around this table for 8 hours. He said, yes, we'll bring you food. We'll bring you drinks. You're allowed out to go to the toilet. I said, oh, thanks. And I said, well, personally, I can't sit indoors all day. I have to go outside, you know, fresh air, walks. And so I insisted on walks, a time when we could have walks, but he was very keen for us not to talk on our walks because he wanted to capture all the conversation. Anyway, this eight-hour conversation was edited down to 3.5 hours. And when it was broadcast in the Netherlands, it had millions of viewers. I mean, something like 12% of the population were watching it. I was amazed because nothing like this has ever happened in Britain. In Britain, you couldn't have 12 white men talking about ideas for hours. You know, you'd have to have a black lesbian and that sort of thing. But Wim Kaiser did what he wanted to do. And it was a wonderful opportunity, really, to engage in a conversation where there was no limit of time. And mm-hmm. and the result was something which many people found very interesting, and yeah. myself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's hilarious stories about the different hotels and separate hotels and cars and everything. It was what led me to the trilogues you had before that with Terence McKenna and Ralph Abraham at Esalen and other places. And we're going to try and talk about in the next 45 minutes about everything that's ever happened. So. It's going to be a challenge, but I'm actually a bit nervous, which has really never happened before. But you and we're going to talk about of course about flow and the sports, the Zen of the West. We'll get into Michael Murphy and all of this, but before we get to that, Rupert, your stuff from the very beginning. Was challenged from the very top. It was called pseudoscience. The senior editor of Nature called for your books to be burned. And you were a youngish man at the time. Can you talk a little bit about the courage it took to write what you believed and what you had evidence for, knowing what might happen?
Well, I knew that what I was doing was controversial. I studied history and philosophy of science at Harvard, as well as studying science at Cambridge. And what I knew from the history and philosophy of science is that at any given time, you have a dominant paradigm. This is Thomas Kuhn's theory of paradigm shifts, which came out just before I was studying at Harvard. So it made a big impact on me. At any given time, you have a sort of a shared model of reality within the scientific community. It's a shared model of how to do science, a shared worldview, which he called a paradigm. And then scientific revolutions occur when the entire framework changes. And these don't happen very often. Most of the time, people do science within the framework. He calls that normal science, which is incremental improvements along established lines. And that's what we've got now. We've got a dominant worldview of mechanistic materialism. The universe is made up of just matter. Consciousness emerges in brains, only in brains. The rest of the universe is totally unconscious. There's no such thing as God except as an idea in human minds and therefore in human brains. And this worldview of mechanistic materialism is the dominant paradigm. Biology and all life must be explained in terms of genes and molecules and nerve impulses and so on. Well, I realized that this is a paradigm. I felt it was extremely narrow, much too narrow to encompass the phenomena of life and mind. The reason I'd become a biologist, because I was fascinated with the nature of life. And you know, I knew all about molecular biology. I was a molecular biologist. I was trained in biochemistry. I worked on molecules. So I can understand and appreciate the fascination of that. And I've published many papers in scientific journals along those lines. The most recent, 2 years ago, in the Proceedings of the Royal Society on cellular senescence and rejuvenation. But I felt we have to go beyond it. I knew it would be controversial. I didn't know quite what form the controversy would take. But in a sense, I was prepared for this to be opposed. And I realized that when I published my first book called A New Science of Life, which came out in Britain in 1981, that this would be a turning point. I knew that it might well mean I couldn't get a job again in the academic or scientific world. So I was prepared for this. I wasn't prepared for quite such a violent reaction, a denunciation on the front page of Nature Journal by the senior editor, Sir John Maddox, which was basically his attempt to excommunicate me from the world of science. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I was prepared in the sense I wasn't surprised that this happened. I thought that science would change quicker than it has done, but it is changing along the lines I've always thought it would. But at the same time, there were many people who supported what I was doing. So although there was a lot of opposition, there was also a lot of support. So I realized that a normal scientific career was not on the cards. Some of my scientific colleagues, particularly older professors at Cambridge, who took an avuncular interest in me, said, look, Sheldrake, they said, you know, if you do this, you'll burn your bridges, you'll go off the rails, it'll destroy your promising scientific career. And they said, our advice is, you know, just keep quiet about all this until you've retired, and then maybe start talking or writing about it. And so that was when I was 25. So I thought, you know, do I really want to wait 40 years to do what I really want to do? And in any case, I may not be fit enough to do it by then. And there's no guarantee that even when I'm retired, that I will, you know, I'll get away with it. So anyway, I just did it anyway. And I've never regretted it, because I think we really do need a massive change in our view of life and consciousness.
And, I feel like you have to talk to, I don't know what movie it's from. I think it's for Margin Call, where the guys just explain it to me like you're talking to a Labrador. But you did get early on, you did get support from colleagues like the big, like David Bohm, like Deepak Chopra. I mean, you know, the guys that I knew about before I knew about you, and your friend Terence McKenna. I mean, he said it best when he said, you know, what these guys are doing. They say, give us one free miracle, and we'll explain the rest.
Yes.
And maybe we can talk a little bit about this morphic resonance and just a few highlights. I know it's difficult, but to explain to the folks how it works.
Morphic resonance is the idea there's a kind of memory in nature, that there's the so-called laws of nature are more like habits. The whole universe has a memory within it. Each kind of thing has a memory, a collective memory. So each kind of crystal has a kind of collective memory. Each species of animal or plant or microbe has a collective memory. Humans have a collective memory, very similar to what Jung called the collective unconscious. And this makes morphic resonance makes quite a lot of testable predictions. The reason I call it morphic resonance is because morphic is the word for form or shape in Greek. And resonance is, well, as in acoustic resonance, it's an automatic connection at a distance. And what I'm suggesting is that similar patterns of activity in self-organizing systems influence subsequent similar patterns across time and space. The resonance leaps across time. That's what's controversial about it. In normal Western science, you have to have a continuous material connection. But what I'm suggesting is that there are connections across time on the basis of similarity. And the theory makes a lot of predictions, which have been tested, so far the tests have given very promising results. For example, if rats learn a new trick in Berlin, then rats in London and New York and Melbourne, Australia, should learn the same trick quicker, just because they've learned it in Berlin. If millions of people do a five-letter word puzzle like Wordle, published every day in the New York Times website, then it should get easier for other people to solve the same problem. People doing Wordle later in the day should find it easier than people who do it first thing in the morning. And that seems to happen. I have tried to get the New York Times to let me look at their data or ask them to analyze it themselves, because they've every single day they're replicating this experiment. But unfortunately, they're terrible spoil sports, and they won't let me see the data, and they won't analyze it themselves. It's frustrating to think there's huge amounts of data being accumulated every single day that could be very relevant to this.
Mm-hmm.
Theory also means that if people learn a new skill, like skateboarding or windsurfing or snowboarding or something, then it should get easier for other people to learn the same skill just because they've learned it. And that would mean that in all sports, for example, and in music, techniques should get easier to learn, mm-hmm. Just because so many people have done them. Now, when you have long established skills, like playing the piano, which people have been doing for centuries, you may not notice it. But when you have new skills like skateboarding, people have actually noticed remarkable improvements. And some of it, of course, is due to video instruction, better skateboard design, better training methods, and so forth. So it's not obvious that it's all morphic resonance, but I think some of it is. And to test this, one would need special experiments. But I think it's highly relevant to sports. And I think that probably the most controversial aspect of morphic resonance is the idea that because it depends on similarity, anything that's really similar to anything in the past will have the most specific and intense morphic resonance. This means that if you ask the question, who in the past was most like me? The answer is me. We're all most like ourselves in the past, more like ourselves than anyone else. And therefore, there's the most specific morphic resonance from our own past. And that means that our own memories can depend on morphic resonance, resonance from our own past states. Now, the usual theory, as you know, the mechanistic materialist theory, is that memories are stored as material traces in brains, modified nerve endings, DNA molecules, phosphorylated proteins. There's a range of theories. No one have been able to actually find the memory traces, despite billions of dollars spent on looking for them. And I think the reason they've proved so elusive is that they're not there, any more than your TV set would have traces of the programs you watched yesterday. It's not how TV works. It may be how video recorders work, but I'm suggesting our brains are more like TV sets than video recorders. They tune in to invisible transmissions from the past, just as TV sets tune in to invisible transmissions through the electromagnetic field in the present. Morphic resonance works across time and across space. So that's basically the idea. And in terms of Western science, it's an extremely unfamiliar idea, radical, revolutionary indeed. In terms of Eastern philosophy, it's not so radical. In Hindu and Buddhist philosophy, the idea of a memory in nature is completely standard. Mm-hmm. It's just the way they think. But in the West, it's shocking as a new idea. I lived and worked in India for 7 years.
Yes.
And when I first thought of morphic resonance, I was doing research at Cambridge and teaching. I was director of studies in cell biology at Clare College, Cambridge. And when I started talking about morphic resonance to my colleagues at Cambridge, at first there was sort of blank incomprehension. And then people sort of made a joke out of it. But when I went to India and talked to my Indian colleagues about morphic resonance, most of them just got it straight away, no problem. Their reaction was the opposite of shock and horror that I encountered in Cambridge. Their reaction was a kind of blasé response, saying, oh, there's nothing new in this idea. The ancient rishis, the seers, have said this thousands of years ago. So they just saw this as a completely standard way of looking at the world and couldn't see what all the fuss was about. So it's very different world views.
Right.
Anyway, that is, in essence, the idea of resonance.
Well, those, your colleagues in India, I remember reading somewhere, you were writing how they were hard-nosed scientists at work and they went home and they were spiritual people. Yes. I found that, absolutely fascinating. Then because, 99% of the scientists, maybe not right now, but, even a decade ago, were hard-nosed atheists. Like you said, everything is mechanical and theories by this Japanese scientist, I think his name is Dr. Emoto or something like this, who talks about the memory of water, mm-hmm. how water molecules remember how to dissect or whatever rust quicker than before. Things like this, and he wrote an excellent children's book, but it's exactly this mechanical thing. I mean, when you say, and there's no proof that the memory is located in the brain, where would it be? I mean, is it everywhere? Does it end somewhere?
Well, I think it's everywhere. You see, but I think where is it located is the wrong question, because mm-hmm. where can only have an answer in terms of space. But memory is a relation in time, and I think it works quite differently. We're used to the idea of spatial memory storage from computer hard drives and libraries and inscriptions on stone and that kind of thing. And but the I think the way that memory works is through a resonance across time. And therefore, in the sense, all the past is potentially present everywhere. You just need to tune into it. Just like all the radio waves and phone calls from North London are present in my room, right where I am at this exact moment. You can't see them, but they're all here and you can tune into them. In the same way, these resonances across time are present potentially everywhere and can be tuned into.
Is it okay? Tuning into it, when you say that, you always hear, you can channel something, or how certain acts just channel stuff, and all the experiences that one has, whether it's playing sports and in particular golf, and you have in your in your book, Ways to Go Beyond, which unfortunately is not yet out in German, but it's out in English. You quote Shivers Irons, the protagonist of Michael Murphy's book, Golf in the Kingdom, exactly about this. Maybe let's go with it from two sides. Number one, what is the attraction of sport? Maybe it's the enactment of the new, I don't know. And these experiences which we have, which are based on synchronicities or coincidences or memories that are really not scientifically explainable by the Western world. What do you think is the attraction of sport? And maybe we'll get to the spiritual side of it as well.
Well, I think there are several elements to the attraction of sports. I think one is play, which is very natural and instinctive in human children, but not only in human children, in many young animals, like young otters, for example, they like playing. And young dogs and wolf cubs like playing. So there's something to do with play, which is deep in our nature. And it's in terms of positive psychology, play involves getting into a kind of flow. And when you're in a flow state, you usually feel happy when you're in the flow of what's happening. So I think that it's deeply biological to play and to enter into these flow states. I think also there's, in sports, something that's quite deeply instinctive, especially for males. I mean, male competition. If we look at almost a wide range of mammalian and bird species, you have competition for mates, alpha males and, stag fights and stuff, and peacock displays, male peacocks line up and display their beautiful tails, and the female picks the most impressive peacock.
Saw that this weekend.
Yeah. So this is, I think at least for men, there's a kind of inherently, competitive urge, which is instinctive as well. And I think that comes into it.
Right.
it's not all sports, of course, are competitive. And so this, so none of these biological instinctive theories account for all of it. I think they're ingredients. For example, mountain climbing is not necessarily a competitive sport. I mean, there is a competition, you know, the first person to climb Everest, that kind of thing. But a lot of people who do rock climbing and mountain climbing are not primarily doing it as a competition. They're doing it because it's engaged in this. And I think why I think of it as a spiritual practice, and why I have a chapter on it in my book, Ways to Go Beyond, which is about seven different spiritual practices, is because spiritual practices are about coming into the present. They're about feeling a connection with something greater than ourselves. And there's many different kinds of spiritual practice, but if you take something that's almost the opposite of sports, like meditation, people are sitting quietly, reciting a mantra or paying attention to their breathing silently. Those are coming into the presence as people can let go of the train of thoughts and the sort of discursive mind and the ruminations that normally go on, our internal chatter, become rather detached from those and come into a sense of presence, of just pure conscious presence, which connects us with the conscious presence underlying all nature. All basic religions and spiritual philosophies have the idea that consciousness is fundamental. Our own minds are part of a vastly greater consciousness. So that is what happens through meditation. But when we're engaged in sports, we also come into the present. The whole point of doing these sports is coming into the present, that you can't sort of chatter, your mind can't be chattering. When I first thought of this was when I was talking to an American friend who had a business and was very busy in his business, and said it preoccupied him. He couldn't stop thinking. He couldn't sleep at night. He tried meditating. It didn't work. But he said he was a mountain climber. So he said by the time he was 30 meters up a rock face, he was completely in the present. Mm-hmm. And similarly, you know, someone in a football match with other players, you know, there's their balls being passed to them, they've got to pass it to someone else, there's a crowd roaring, etc. It's not the time to think about have you paid the gas bill or some remark your girlfriend made yesterday that annoyed you or something. You have to be completely in the present. And I think that's one of the reasons why dangerous sports are so attractive to people at the moment. I had a talk with a German, young German, who is the world champion of the free highline walking. It's like a tightrope,
right?
And he has a 300 meter drop, and he has no safety harness. And you know, it's obviously incredibly dangerous, and it's dangerous, and it's precisely because it's so dangerous that he has to be totally concentrated, totally in the present. And he said for him, this is the most blissful experience he knows. He saw it as a spiritual experience. And that's why he keeps doing it. His girlfriend's desperately trying to persuade him to stop doing it, because, of course, most people who take up dangerous sports are young. And the reason there aren't many old people in dangerous sports is that they're dangerous and a lot of them die. I think that's also the same reason that people are attracted to speed. I mean, I'm personally not very attracted to speed and driving fast, but it is the national hobby in Germany.
It is.
And you know, I don't know if Germany still has no speed limit on.
We still don't.
Yeah, well, you see, almost everywhere else does. So this is something that's particularly big in Germany, speed. Right. And I think one of the reasons that driving cars fast or motorcycles fast or downhill skiing or driving jet planes is the same thing, that you have to be completely concentrated because it's so dangerous that any lapse of attention and you're dead. I think that the point about sports is that they bring you into the present through the need to concentrate on movement and activity. Mm-hmm. Whereas meditation brings you into the present through letting go of attachment to all sorts of things. Sports are another way of coming into the present. Mm-hmm. And I think one reason I think they work is that ultimate consciousness, if we think about theories of ultimate consciousness or divine consciousness, they show there's a kind of differentiation within ultimate consciousness. The Hindu model of Sat, Chit, Ananda, you know, Sat is the ground of consciousness. It's the mind which experiences things, which is the ground of being. Chit is the contents of consciousness, what you know, what they call names and forms. And so, you know, for us to be conscious, our normal consciousness, there's us who know things or experience things, and then there's what we experience. Like right now, I'm experiencing seeing you on a computer screen, and beyond you, if I raise my eyes, looking to the sky and trees outside the window. Those are contents of consciousness, and so are the words that we're listening to and saying. But there's behind that is the consciousness from which they come. And then the third component of this Trinitarian model of consciousness is, on the one hand, bliss. Ananda in the Hindu term is bliss or joy. On the other hand, it's movement or change. In the Christian model of the Trinity, God the Father is the ground of consciousness. I am who I am, as God says in the Old Testament to Moses, conscious being in the present. The Logos, the second person of the Holy Trinity, is about names and forms, that which is known, ideas, forms, shapes, being, existence, life, and so on. And then the Holy Spirit is the principle of movement, change, flow. It's always represented by the flight of birds, the flow of wind, the flames of fire. Mm-hmm. These are dynamical principles. So I think that in meditation, we come into a link to the ground of all consciousness, the Sat, or the God the Father aspect of the Holy Trinity. And in sports, and also in dancing and music, we link to the flow principle, namely the spirit principle. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why seemingly very different practices can all be spiritual practices, because they relate to different aspects of ultimate consciousness or ultimate being. Right. Which is not a unified, undifferentiated whole, but in most traditions has this inner differentiation.
Mm-hmm. I took a bunch of notes. The first one thing I got to get out of the way is, you mentioned that most people that try dangerous sports are young because they don't get old.
So yes.
A friend of mine was asked to write a lullaby for a children's record. And they put his song on the B-side of the album. And he said, my God, how bad must the A-side be if they ever get around to listening to my song? So it's very similar. But, you know, I have five children, and you mentioned children, how they play. And it's always fascinating to see how children play versus how we adults play. Somehow a switch flips over, where when somebody gets hurt, not everybody stops. They keep playing. And you mentioned David Papineau in your book as well, where it's in some sports, it's almost cool to cheat. There's still a couple of things I want to ask you about. This being in the moment, this flow state, and Thichen Mihaly talks about it, a balance between skill and the challenge, and this feeling of nothingness. It's really not nothing. It is something. I mean, you know, coaches say, well, just think of nothing, you know. But I think the zone is, you're thinking but not thinking, which is a big difference of just having an empty head.
Mm.
That's one thing. And then, as I said before, Michael Murphy describes sports as the Zen of the West. For me, Zen really is like a doorway, because, you know, the millions and millions of people who play sports, who practice sports, they don't play for the trophy. They just play for a feeling. They play for a feeling. They play for this this enactment of the new. I think even Michael Murphy called it, which is a little bit of a dangerous a thought for some very religious people. Can we talk about religion briefly? Because yeah. Spiritual, you know, one of the things is that when we look at the spiritual side of sports, when people hear the word spiritual, they think of the Pope and they think of the Dalai Lama and they think of Desmond Tutu. Maybe they don't really think of what I think is spiritual. And to me, the militant religious freaks are just as dangerous as the militant atheists. How can we talk about this? When you talk about the spiritual side, how is it religious?
Not usually, no. I think that the I think spirituality is a bigger framework than religion. Spirituality is about connection with forms of consciousness greater than our own. Mm-hmm. And that can include team games where, you know, when we're part of a team, that's greater than just an individual. And so, but there's also this sense of connection with forms of consciousness beyond our own. And in most religions, there's the idea that there are many forms of consciousness beyond our own. There's the ultimate consciousness, which in the Western tradition we call God, but there are also angels and saints and ancestors. There's all sorts of other spirit beings. And it's not as if there's just nothing between us and the divine. There are many forms of consciousness beyond our own. And I think that spiritual practices are about connecting with these more than human forms of consciousness. So I think sports is one way where we get into the flow and we come to the present, and there's a sense that we go beyond ourselves of our normal limitations. Meditation is another, rituals are another, music and chanting and singing are another, taking part in festivals and ceremonies, sharing celebrations with others. It's another way of going beyond. And I think rituals help take us beyond precisely because they depend on morphic resonance. And I mean, this is of course my own theory. It's not standard teaching of the Pope or Hindu pundits or mullahs in mosques. But I mean, I think what underlies the power of rituals is the fact through doing repetitive actions, particular sequences of words, movements, gestures, and so forth, that have been done that way before, they're deliberately done as similarly as possible. And that puts the present participants into resonance with all those who've done it before. So there's, through rituals, there's a sense of connection, not only with other members of the group who are taking part in the ritual, for example, the Passover for Jewish people, Christian Holy Communion, the American Thanksgiving dinner, you know, these kinds of rituals, which may be religious or national or secular even, enable the present participants to be bonded together by sharing in the ritual, but also through taking part in a traditional ritual connected across time with all those who've done it before. So there's a sense, again, a connection, including a connection across time. Mm-hmm. And I think that religions have the advantage of being social. I mean, you can be spiritual but not religious, and many people in the modern world are. Mm-hmm. But this is usually an individual pursuit. It's a kind of individual pick and mix of practices. You know, I've been to people's houses where they'd have sort of Native American dream catchers on the wall, and then sort of Tibetan bowls that produce Tibetan bowl sounds, and then maybe a sort of meditation corner with the images of the Buddha and maybe Ganesh and a few Mayan images and stuff. The one thing they usually don't have is anything Christian. So they usually operate.
That's worn by the heavy metal crowd. They wear the cross.
So I think that the point about traditional religions is they involve communities and make the spiritual life more collective through sharing in ceremonies and festivals. And when I lived in India, I was very impressed at the way in these Hindu festivals, you know, everyone's there at the temple, the bells, there's the processions, the children, the old people, you know, everyone's participating, linked together. We still have that to some degree at Christmas, here in Europe, and to a lesser extent at Easter, but mostly, and some in Italy and Spain, they still have local festivals of the patron saint, which are still very participatory and bind communities together. And there's nothing better than a festival or a ceremony for binding a community. And we need to have not just individuals, we need communities, because we're social animals. So I think that's one of the functions of religion, and one of the blessings of religion, really, to through rituals and ceremonies, which you can't really do on your own as part of a pick and mix spirituality. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, I think they provide a framework for children and basic stories that are shared by the whole culture, and so on. And I think that when you have societies where these are provided by the religion, it's a healthier society, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can, of course, be pathologized, and religions can be perverted and turned into ways of attacking other social groups and so on. Everything human can be perverted. But I think that the religious dimension goes beyond spirituality, or at least integrates spiritual experiences within a more social and traditional communal setting.
Mm-hmm. Does God change?
I think so, yes. I mean, if we have the idea that God is, take a Christian, I'm a Christian myself, I'm an Anglican, a member of the Church of England, which is sort of halfway between Protestant and Catholic. It's sort of one of the primal English compromises. that if you take a Christian view, and if you take the view that God is works through and in history, I mean, just the incarnation of Jesus, if we, God changed by Jesus being born and changing what happened in the human world. And I think if God knows everything, the usual view is that God's omniscient, then, you know, as ChatGPT comes along, then God must know that ChatGPT's come along.
Right.
And it wasn't there 20 years ago. So insofar as God knows everything, God must change. If one thinks of God totally outside space and time, then you have a very remote God who's in a supernatural realm and not interactive with us. But the whole Judeo-Christian tradition is about interactions between people and God. And that would imply there's an element of God that changes. And in fact, the whole idea of the Holy Spirit is precisely a moving principle. It's part of the divine nature, but it's about movement and change. You know, the festival of Pentecost, when the Spirit inspires the disciples and they start speaking in tongues and so on, there's a change in them, and the change in them is brought about by the divine Spirit. So it's a principle of change. So I think there's an aspect of God that changes. There may be, no doubt, are aspects that are transcendent and beyond change, but I think God has to have some aspect of change. Otherwise, God can't really be related to history of the world and what's happening.
Exactly. You mentioned ChatGPT. I know your time is very limited. Your thoughts on AI as... I mean, it's exploded. I mean, artificial intelligence, and it's teaching itself. And I mean, should we be afraid of this?
Well, personally, I'm not. My wife says I'm burying my head in the sand. I say I rather like burying my head in the sand if it means not worrying too much about things. I don't worry about it as much as some people, partly because ChatGPT, like all our digital technologies, is embedded within digital computers. Digital computers are deterministic machines, which I think are incapable of consciousness precisely because they're deterministic machines. I think we're capable of consciousness precisely because we're not deterministic machines. Machines are a very bad metaphor for the whole of nature and life. They're a specialist part of the world created by humans to work very predictably and determinately. I mean, most of nature is indeterminate. You know, the veins on the back of leaves, if you look at a leaf, each leaf is different. None of them are identical. Look at products from a factory, and ideally they're identical. Computers are identical to other computers of the same brand, and And they work with a deterministic manner, because if you press an A on your keyboard, you want an A to appear on the screen, not some random other number. And because of that, I don't think they're capable of coming to life or being conscious, because I think life and consciousness involve the patterning of otherwise indeterminate events by morphic fields, which are how morphic resonance works. So I don't think computers can become conscious in their present form. Mm-hmm. I don't think ChatGPT would become conscious. It's certainly become very clever and beat people at games like chess. And of course, we've had computers that do that for years. And now ChatGPT can compose undergraduate essays, possibly better than most undergraduates. It's a big problem for universities.
Right. And it's a big problem for artists, for the arts.
Yes, and they
can, authors, for musicians.
They can make graphics and things. They can compose music, and mm-hmm. so they can do a lot of things. So they may threaten jobs. And I suppose if we put them in charge of our military arsenals, then they could easily start wars. Yes, I think there are certainly dangers in it, but I don't think that they're going to become conscious and take over. Because I don't think that anything within a machine, a deterministic machine, can do that.
Okay, let's finish up with this. And again, it's this. I was fortunate enough to spend some time in Japan and in Indonesia and in the Middle East as well, in Asia. Medicine. I mean, Western medicine is really not geared up to be preventive. The way I see it, I mean, it's geared to be curative. No, for that to work, folks need to get sick. I'm of course heading towards the topic of diet and the mushroom. There is this movement, and it started, I don't know how it started. I guess for me, it started with Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance way back when. We have now products, the reishi mushroom from Japan. I mean, natural products that are proven that are used in Japan or in the Far East for treating heavy diseases. I mean, my 86-year-old mother every month gets her supply of reishi mushrooms, and she firmly believes that they help her stay fit. And one of the things happening in Silicon Valley, of course, is also this concept or this phenomenon of microdosing psilocybin. What do you think of that?
Well, I think actually your starting point about Western medicine not having a preventive aspect, it does actually. I mean, with vitamins, for example, or vaccinations, these are strongly preventive aspects of Western medicine that have made a huge difference. But I agree, most of it's about curing diseases once they've happened. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but my son Merlin is a mycologist, and he wrote a book, Entangled Life, which is a best-selling book about fungi. Mm-hmm. And he's terribly keen on me taking reishi and chaga and lion's mane. And so he, you know, when he was a child, I used to make sure he'd taken his sort of, eaten his meal. He sort of inquires if I'm taking my lion's mane and stuff. So I take these mushroom supplements. I don't know whether they're doing me any good or not. So because I do yoga, I meditate, I do other things. And the controlled experiment would be to have sort of 2 or 3 months without yoga and meditation and just mushroom supplements, etc. I haven't done those experiments. So I just don't know how much I'm doing. And I don't know how much good microdoses do. I mean, some people I know are keen on microdoses of psychedelics. I have tried them myself, and I didn't notice much difference, just made me feel slightly queasy. Mm-hmm. I'm not against psychedelics, but I personally think it's better to take the occasional macro dose than micro doses. So I think psychedelics, as I discuss in my book Ways to Go Beyond, can be an opening to the spiritual realm if they're taken in the right way. And I think for many young people, they are a kind of rite of passage into a broader understanding or experience of consciousness.
A doorway, just like a Zen and just like sport. Absolutely. This is good stuff. I do want to point folks to your website, sheldrake.org. I also urge them at the very least to subscribe to your newsletter, which I get. Rupert's books, From Ways to Go Beyond to The Evolutionary Mind, that's the transcripts of those trilogues you had with McKenna and Abrams, are phenomenal. Your YouTube videos of your talks are incredible. Any tours being planned on your end, Rupert?
No, I'm actually, my wife and I are having a no-fly year this year, so we're not going anywhere by plane.
Okay.
I have been invited to speak in something called the Bergen Debates in Norway in December, and they wanted me to debate Sam Harris, which I agreed to do, but then he wouldn't agree to debate me. Mm. But instead, I'm going to be doing a debate with Anil Seth, who's a British materialist neuroscientist. Mm-hmm. And I had to be strongly motivated because it takes 2.5 days to get from England to Bergen by train, via Germany.
Okay.
As a channel tunnel, Germany, etc. So I will be, that's my only big foreign adventure this year. The rest of the time I'll be here in Britain.
Well,
thanks to Zoom and modern telecommunications, I mean, it means I still feel very connected with the rest of the world. At any rate, no tours.
We are. Yes, and thanks to Zoom, this was possible today. So I thank you again very much. Our hour is up. I know you have to run. It's been, I've touched maybe on 5% of the stuff I wanted to talk about, there's always hope for next time. I asked you for a personal favor. I asked you to leave us with a Terence McKenna story. I don't know if you remember that request, but can we close the show with a little, and what a man he was. I mean, those trilogues, they're just so funny, and they, funny is really not the most of the first thing that you were planning, but what impressed me with these things, and folks, you got to watch these. I mean, these are 2-3 hours of three people, and the discipline you have, the way you don't interrupt one another, the way discussions should be, and it's something that I try to do. I'm not doing a very good job at it, but one little Terence McKenna story, if you will.
Oh, gosh. right. Well, fairly soon after I met Terence McKenna, I was going to Los Angeles, and he said, let's meet in Los Angeles. He said, I'm doing my radio show there. And I said, when's your radio show? He said, well, it's on an alternative radio station called KPFK. And he said, it runs from 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. And so I said, well, that seems a very odd time, Terence. And, I usually go to bed before 5 a.m. He said, my audience are insomniacs, he said. And he said, and at that time in the morning, you can say whatever you like. He said, no one in authority is listening. And so I did have this outrageous 3-hour conversation on air with Terence McKenna on KPFK Los Angeles while most people slept. and Terence had this audience of people rang in. I mean, so some really weird people rang in. There were some very interesting people. It was a call-in show. And that was tremendous fun. And Terence did have this kind of niche audience of people who loved what he was doing, but it all had to be very under the radar. And anyway, that was, he was doing this as a regular show, but, being in this sort of slightly seedy radio, alternative radio studio. And,
at 3 a.m.
Yes. That was one of my many experiences with Terence. Took me to places I would never otherwise have been.
There you go. Well, Rupert, thank you very much for the hour today. It's been an absolute pleasure. I wish you and yours nothing but the best. And I look forward to what's to come. Your youthfulness is astounding. I'm sure there's many, many more things to come from you. Ladies and gentlemen, sheldrake.org, check it out. Check out his books. Rupert, thank you very much. Be well.
Very good to be with you.
To the Linksland.